This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Just ahead, we'll look at gun violence in Chicago. Has an effort called Street Outreach helped? We'll hear about a community trying what's known as paramedicine. It's designed to cut down on emergency medical services. Meatpacking facilities were not a good place to be during the pandemic. Some are now calling for changes. Illinois, one big state, but it's become quite polarized. We'll take a look at the political landscape. And we can all come up with some choice words for 2021. We'll hear about a new list that singles out a few that were overused. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, meatpacking facilities have seen numerous COVID outbreaks. Should changes be implemented? Also, a strategy to combat gun violence. Is it working? And teachers and students have had a difficult time during the pandemic, but so have school nurses. We'll hear more. It's all coming up on Statewide. Illinois is a Democratic state, arguably one of the bluest in the country. But if you look outside of Chicago and the collar counties, you see mostly a sea of red. And that deepening polarity promises to shape this year's race for Illinois governor in what could be a big Republican year across the nation. Politics reporter Dave McKinney of WBEZ takes a closer look at our two Illinois.
If you listen to John Spencer, it doesn't sound like he's joking when he says he keeps his party affiliation mostly to himself. Why?
Sometimes you might get hit. I try not to say too much to anybody anymore.
Spencer is the Democratic chairman in Clay County, a mostly rural, white, and conservative Republican enclave 240 miles south of Chicago. He works at Walmart now because a construction business he once ran went under.
I couldn't buy a job now if I wanted one in the line of construction because nobody wants a Democrat on their property.
Starting in 1998, Democratic losses downstate escalated over 20 years. The number of Illinois counties voting Democratic in gubernatorial elections declined each cycle. Spencer himself tried running for the Illinois House in 2020, but got clobbered. He said voters didn't like his focus on infrastructure, schools, jobs, or broadband internet. All they wanted to hear about, he said, were gun rights and abortion restrictions. That's all given rise to pro-gun, anti-abortion Republicans like State Senator Darren Bailey from Xenia. He's one of four Republican candidates who has announced they're running for governor next year. And he has his own theory about why Democrats aren't winning many downstate counties in governor's elections.
I boil a lot of it down to moral integrity.
As a legislator, Bailey signed on to an effort to kick Chicago out of Illinois and have it become its own state. The measure went nowhere. Bailey has since backed away from the concept now that he's running to challenge Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker. If Bailey gets out of a primary to win in November, he's going to have to find some votes in Chicago's suburbs and in the city he once wanted to jettison. Bailey's political ideology is rooted in his religious beliefs, and he quotes the Old Testament in making the case he's the right man for governor.
Proverbs 28:2 says, when there is moral rot in a nation, its government topples easily, but wise and knowledgeable leaders bring stability.
Journalist Lou Jacobson has studied the trend nationally of Republicans winning more counties than Democrats and wrote about it in the nationally respected political newsletter Sabato's Crystal Ball. He says in Illinois, Republicans like Bailey face long political odds so long as densely populated Chicago and the collar counties remain blue. There aren't enough votes downstate to offset that Democratic advantage. But as geographic divisions harden in Illinois, Jacobson says polarization worsens.
It's not great for our political debate.
And Jacobson says that's unhealthy in a democracy.
You have people in red areas who are never seeing blue voters. It just further pushes the two sides away from each other and gives them less and less common ground.
Now, there's been one exception to this trend. In 2018, Pritzker, the Democratic incumbent, won on a historic turnout in Cook County and a near sweep of the collar counties. But he also clawed back some of the lost political turf downstate, and Pritzker's campaign says he wants to hold on to that in 2022. Since declaring for re-election, Pritzker has visited the region almost two dozen times, including a recent stop in far downstate Williamson County. A reporter there pressed him on his seeming lack of support in that part of the state.
Well, let me start with, I think I'm more favored than you think I am.
The last Democratic gubernatorial nominee really to do well downstate was former Congressman Glenn Pouchard of Marion. He narrowly lost the 1998 election. One of the 43 counties Pouchard carried was Clay County, home to Bailey and to Democrat John Spencer. Spencer wouldn't give Pouchard good odds at carrying the county these days.
But now, if Glenn was to run for dog catcher against a cat, the cat would get 90% of the vote.
And that's the story of two Illinois, the one that's blue in the city and suburbs and that elected Pritzker 3 years ago, and the other that's deeply red and growing redder, searching for a shot at political relevance in 2022. This is Dave McKinney.
One of Illinois' longest-serving officials won't seek re-election. Chicago Congressman Bobby Rush, who's 75, says he's entering a new level of life and he plans to focus on his work as a pastor on the city's south side. There are estimates as many as 20 Democrats are eyeing his congressional seat. Rush was a civil rights activist in the 60s and a former member of the Black Panther Party. He was first elected to Congress in 1992. Meanwhile, Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger is bypassing a run for statewide office. Instead, he'll be devoting himself full-time to fighting what he says is political extremism. Kinzinger's a critic of former President Trump and a member of the House panel probing the January 6th insurrection. He announced his plans Wednesday online and on his Twitter account.
This time last year, I hoped victory would come in a matter of months. Now I see it will take years. That's why I'm transitioning from serving just one corner of Illinois into fighting this new nationwide mission full-time.
A Kinzinger aide confirmed he won't run for Illinois governor or the U.S. Senate in 2022. The aide also says the Shanahan Republican intends to campaign against pro-Trump extremists in primaries across the country this year. In recent years, the city of Chicago has poured millions of dollars into an anti-violence approach known as street outreach. During that same period, gun violence in the city has skyrocketed, and it raises an obvious question. Is this an effective strategy? Northwestern University professor Andrew Papakristos studies Chicago gun violence and the street outreach efforts, and he spoke with Patrick Smith.
We have in Chicago this effort at trying to prevent gun violence that is often referred to as street outreach. What do people mean? What do you mean when you use the term street outreach?
So street outreach is actually a very old idea. It goes back to the 1940s in Chicago, the Chicago Area Project. And it's changed over time, but the core idea is that a lot of the individuals who are involved in violence, especially gun violence, tend to be disconnected or locked out of a lot of mainstream institutions. So they spend a lot of their time quite literally on the street. So in order to reach them, and they are hard to reach, you have to use and employ individuals with same lived experience, credible messengers, people who know the neighborhood and the networks and the relationships. And the idea is you meet people where they are, which is literally, again, sort of on outside, on the street, on the corner, you know, in groups, in cliques, in networks.
And so we have a number of anti-violence organizations in Chicago that employ this kind of street outreach now. What do we know about who these anti-violence organizations are reaching?
Yeah. So I think – so we're doing research on two big efforts, Chicago CRED and Communities Partnering for Peace, CP4P. I think one of the key things that we're learning across all of these efforts is that street outreach can actually find – individuals that are in immediate harm's way, individuals whose risk for victimizations are 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 times higher than other people in their own neighborhood. So we are actually talking about individuals whose risk of being a victim of gun violence dwarfs people that live on the same block. Statistically speaking, many of these individuals are safer playing Russian roulette than they are in terms of their risks of being a gunshot victim at somebody else's hand. I mean, it is staggering the amount of risk they face and the amount of need that there is to sort of bring that risk down. The levels are truly off the charts.
So they're connecting with the highest risk people. Are they succeeding in getting them to take advantage of programs or choose different outlets or get involved in something more positive?
They are connecting them to services. And many of the participants are taking advantage of these services. So 63% of the CRED participants who didn't have a high school diploma got a high school diploma. That's a huge win. We know that before COVID, 15 to 20% of outreach participants of CP4P saw improvements in employment, full-time or part-time employment. Now, of course, COVID probably had a bigger effect on a lot of these young men's employment than other people's employment, but they were really making strides in this space ahead of time, if we can get them to do that.
So if these programs are reaching the people most likely to be involved in gun violence, and if they are having huge wins, at least in some areas, as you put it, why is violence so high in Chicago?
Yeah, that is the question everybody wants to unpack. There are a couple of reasons why. And the first thing I want to say, Patrick, and I know you know this, is we are actually talking about a nationwide trend of an uptick in gun violence. It's not just Chicago. If it were just Chicago, the answer would be slightly different. But there are important things when we do talk about just Chicago. Gun violence is so embedded into the city. The scale of the problem is so large that no single program that focuses on individuals will be able to put a dent in an aggregate rate. If we have 900 crews or factions in the city of Chicago, and they each have 10 or 15 members, you're talking about 10,000 plus individuals who may or may not be involved in disputes or conflicts. We have 200 outreach workers. So the number of people they'll be able to connect with is very, very, very small. But let me be clear. Finding people, connecting people, and keeping people alive are super important, and we want to do all of those things, but it just means that that's where the impact should be seen most immediately. Beyond that, it's just real. The problem is just too big.
So does that mean, what you're saying, does that mean that if we poured hundreds of millions of dollars more into this and greatly expanded street outreach, it still wouldn't really have much of an impact on the number of shootings we saw in Chicago?
I think it's not outreach alone. So let me be clear. I think outreach is emerging as a really important tool. I think what we need to do is pour millions and tens of millions of dollars in building violence prevention infrastructure, which means building a workforce that's trained and has the tools that they need to succeed. So in addition to violence interrupters, we need trauma care specialists. We need other sorts of first responders. We need victim services. All that immediate response that needs to be coordinated. But at the same time, you need to have these mid-range strategies and these truly transformative strategies. So if you have a bunch of job readiness programs, but no jobs at the end, it's going to feed back on itself. So all of those things kind of have to happen at the same time. But we need to invest in infrastructure that is locally coordinated, that has the support of the city and the state and federal government. It needs to be consistently funded too. I think one of the things that happens in this space is once you get a good thing going, you have to keep the lights on. And then you're scrambling to try to keep people employed, to do all these things. And, eventually these kind of things can fade away. I think we need consistent investment, and we need to make sure we bolster the things we think are having an impact.
That's Northwestern University professor Andrew Papakristos. He spoke with Patrick Smith about Chicago gun violence and a strategy known as street outreach. The coronavirus has killed hundreds of meat plant workers and sickened thousands more. Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, many are still searching for answers and calling for change. Natalie Krebs has this report.
In late October, Debbie Berkowitz shared some shocking statistics at a U.S. House subcommittee hearing.
More workers have died from COVID-19 in the last 18 months in the meat and poultry industry than died from all work-related causes in the industry in the past 15 years, and I bet it's more than that now that we have better numbers.
Berkowitz is a worker safety and health expert and a former senior policy advisor for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. A congressional report issued this fall found more than 59,000 workers employed by the nation's top five meat processing companies were infected with COVID in the first year of the pandemic. At least 269 workers died. The report is one of the few documents that has offered insight into the tragic outbreaks.
Meatpacking plants continue to drive coronavirus outbreaks across rural America.
More than half the workers at a plant in Perry, Iowa, have now tested positive.
Companies in Iowa have resisted calls to close, even as case numbers soar.
The nation's largest meatpacking companies, like Tyson and Smithfield, have long maintained that they've worked hard to protect workers. Here's Claudia Copeland, Chief Medical Officer for Tyson Foods.
We've invested hundreds of millions of dollars to transform our facilities with protective measures, everything from temperature scanners, workstation dividers, social distance monitors, masking, and our always-on testing program.
But the congressional report painted the company's responses in a very different light. It concluded much more could have been done, and criticized companies for not working quickly to reduce crowding inside their facilities at the start of the pandemic. But at the congressional hearing, Congresswoman Marionette Miller-Meeks pushed back. She's a Republican from Iowa, the nation's top pork-producing state. Miller-Meeks said plants took many precautions, and she emphasized the impact closing meat plants had on farmers and the food supply chain.
Do any of you know how many farmers committed suicide? Because that happened in my district when farmers had no place to take their hogs or their beef or their chickens.
With the ongoing attention from federal lawmakers, the pressure is on companies to address issues before the next pandemic hits. In November, Smithfield became the first meatpacking company to reach an agreement with the U.S. Department of Labor. The company says it will make systematic changes to its infectious disease policies. Melissa Perry is an occupational health researcher at George Washington University. She says it's important for companies to improve worker conditions and also be more transparent about outbreaks.
In epidemiology and in public health surveillance, it's data that you need first and foremost as your bedrock foundation to address any kind of outbreak or any kind of health problem. And so those systems weren't in place.
Still, others, including workers' unions, criticize the government for lack of oversight. Records show OSHA issued very few COVID-related citations to plants in 2020. Going forward, some Democrats say they're making worker safety a priority. President Joe Biden called it a, quote, national priority and moral imperative. One Iowa lawmaker wants to introduce a workers' bill of rights, which would include minimum wage requirements and paid sick leave. I'm Natalie Krebs for Harvest Public Media.
That story comes from Side Effects Public Media, a Midwest reporting collaboration focused on public health. We'll have more on that series. It's coming up here on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, the struggle of being a school nurse made more difficult during a pandemic. Well, up next, we continue our series on meatpacking facilities. Immigrants make up an estimated 40% of the workforce in those meat processing plants. Last year's wave of COVID outbreaks at the facilities revealed how protections are lacking for many of these workers. Natalie Krebs continues our coverage.
Amner Martinez still doesn't really know all the details from when his 74-year-old father, Concepcion, got really sick with COVID near the start of the pandemic.
Tengo una pregunta.
He calls him from his office in downtown Des Moines, Iowa, to ask,
¿cuánto tiempo le dieron libre?
How long was he out of work for?
Una semana.
Sí.
1 week.
Martinez's father has worked at a Tyson's food plant in central Iowa for more than 2 decades. It was the site of an outbreak early in the pandemic that affected more than 700 workers. Martinez says his father, who he calls a workaholic like himself, didn't tell him just how sick he was until he was recovering.
He said that he was like on his knees, basically talking to God.
Martinez says the Tyson job has done a lot for his family. They're originally from Guatemala. The job brought them to Iowa from California in the 90s.
In 1995 in California, my parents were making $4.25 an hour.
Martinez says in Iowa, his parents' wages doubled. Martinez also worked for Tyson and now runs his own staffing agency. His clients include some meatpacking companies. Martinez tells clients he knows how hard the job is, but
I also know the opportunity that has provided my entire family to just move out of poverty, really.
It's only in the past few decades that immigrants like the Martinez family have made up a significant percentage of meatpacking workers. Dave Swenson is an economist at Iowa State University. He says the workforce shift started in the 1960s, when an Iowa beef packing plant developed a more efficient way of processing meat. Swenson says it upended the nation's industry and unions and also made the job more dangerous.
Pay went down that much. The kind of work that people were doing was repetitive, led to injuries. The line speeds were fast.
Swenson says the old, mostly white and black workforce started quitting. Companies initially struggled to find workers to replace them.
They found they were able to be attractive to and retain workers who were foreign-born, primarily those who were refugees from Asia and or people who were coming up from Mexico and Central America.
Fast forward to 2020, and those immigrant workers and their families suffered as the virus swept through meat plants. Caroline Johnson is the clinical director for Proteus, a nonprofit that's launching a pilot health clinic in a central Iowa meatpacking plant. It's an effort to remove barriers to healthcare, like lack of access to health insurance, transportation, and language barriers.
And unfortunately, they have so many health disparities and are at greater risk for diabetes, hypertension, and cholesterol.
These are conditions that also put them at a higher risk of getting severe COVID. Tyson Foods launched a similar initiative and opened 7 pilot health clinics across the country. But these programs cover a small fraction of the nation's meatpacking workers. Claudia Corwin, an occupational medicine specialist with the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, says the pandemic showed where government public health programs fell short.
Very, very few states have actual protections for vulnerable food system workers in the event of public health emergencies like the COVID pandemic.
Funding for public health has been dwindling for years. Some states like Iowa cut state-level initiatives aimed at minority health in the years leading up to the pandemic. So workers have suffered. And Iowa State Survey found the pandemic took a mental, physical, and financial toll on workers in the state's rural meatpacking towns. But many said they're afraid to speak up about health and safety concerns for fear of retaliation. I'm Natalie Krebs for Harvest Public Media.
It's not just COVID that is a public health problem. Several new tick-borne viruses have been identified in the Midwest in the past decade, including what's known as the Heartland virus. But researchers say these are only the ones we know about, and more are likely to emerge in coming years. And as Shayla Farzan reports, scientists are working to identify the next generation of tick-borne illnesses.
On a recent summer afternoon outside St. Louis, two scientists drove along a rutted gravel road, a plume of dust trailing behind them. They hopped out of their SUV wearing knee-high gaiters over their boots and hiked into the forest at Washington University's Tyson Research Center. That day, they were going hunting for ticks. As it turns out, it doesn't take that much equipment to collect a lot of ticks here.
So we have sections of cloth that we're going to lay on the ground, and then Tupperware where we put dry ice.
Solny Adelstensen is an ecologist at Tyson. She says the dry ice is the most important component because it releases carbon dioxide. The Lone Star tick, the most common species in Missouri, actively searches for animal hosts through the carbon dioxide they exhale.
They're so aggressive. When they sense you, they just will chase you down. And that's why these dry ice traps work really well.
About an hour later, the cloth on the ground was crawling with dozens of ticks. And that's a good thing, because these researchers want as many as they can get. It's all part of an ongoing study to track how common tick-borne viruses are at the reserve. David Wang is working with Adelstensen and others on this project. The WashU microbiologist says two new tick-borne viruses have recently emerged in the Midwest. The Heartland virus, first diagnosed in two Missouri farmers in 2012, and Bourbon virus, discovered a few years later in Kansas. But, he says,
there's no way that those are the only two tick-borne pathogenic viruses here. And it's just that people haven't been looking.
Wang says there are probably other new viruses that have gone undiagnosed, simply because doctors don't know what they are.
The classic way that medicine works is you look for the usual suspects. But again, you can only find what you're looking for. So when it's negative for everything, then what do you do? In order to find something that's not in the usual set, you need to take a different approach.
In this study, they're using genetic sequencing to figure out what kind of viruses the ticks are carrying. And that involves literally mashing up a lot of ticks. Ishmael Aziati is a postdoctoral researcher who's processed thousands of them so far. The ticks are divided up into plastic tubes filled with tiny steel balls, each one smaller than a sesame seed. Aziati pops the tubes into a whirring machine in a WashU lab.
We want to break the ticks up and release its contents. And so this machine, it just mechanically will shake these things up with the beads hitting each other.
It's the first of many steps to extract the genetic material from these ticks. Later, he'll feed the data into a computer. And here's where it gets interesting. The research team will compare the genetic sequences to known viruses to see how closely they match and which ones could be new variations. It's like trying to find a needle in a haystack, says Deborah Hudman. She's a tick researcher at A.T. Still University in Kirksville, Missouri, who is not affiliated with the study.
The viruses, we know they're here, and they're really scary because they kill people. But there are very low prevalence, and they're really hard to detect. It's, you know, like 1% of ticks.
Hudman says these projects take a lot of time, energy, and money, partly because you have to test a lot of ticks. Despite the challenges, she says this kind of research is vital in Missouri, which she calls a Goldilocks environment for ticks.
It is just absurd the number of ticks that are here. We're just in that sweet spot. We're not too hot, not too cold, not too dry. So, and we have a lot of wildlife. We have a lot of forests.
And with climate change expected to expand tick ranges and their seasonal activity in the U.S., studying these new diseases could become even more pressing in the future. I'm Shayla Farzan.
One Indiana community is redefining emergency medical services. Typically, an ambulance arrives in a crisis, but a new approach called community paramedicine is trying to prevent the emergency altogether. Carter Barrett looks at whether one town's success can be replicated.
It's a September morning, and community paramedic Darren Foreman is on the way to his second appointment of the day.
Every social has a medical aspect. Every medical has a social aspect.
Mm-hmm. We pull up to a modest-sized house. The front porch is decorated with pumpkins and corn stalks for fall.
Good day, young lady.
Can you say hi?
Hi, guys. Hi. Did I bring a friend?
Foreman is in charge of Project Swaddle, which aims to provide health care to moms with risky pregnancies, both before and after giving birth, in an effort to reduce maternal and child mortality rates and supplement a growing obstetrics healthcare desert. Ashley Newkirk, 31, is part of Project Swaddle. She gave birth to her third child, Wilder, 5 weeks before.
Like for the baby, he checks like his heart rate and he listens to his chest and weighs him and measures his head and his length. And then he gets my weight and my vitals, make sure we don't have any questions. And if we do, he answers them.
Good. How's our head strength today? You need to get a head up? Like, leave me be, dude. Not going to do it. Okay, I get it.
Newkirk enrolled in the program for this baby because she developed gestational diabetes with her first pregnancy.
When we have a mom that's not really maybe expected to go all the way to term or maybe not even be able to get to, you know, viability, and we get them all the way through, there's just no better feeling. I get that picture of the baby in the hospital with the mom, and all's right with the world. It
does. So this approach, it's called mobile integrated health, or community paramedicine. That idea is to meet people where they are. In Crawfordsville, the teams drive to people's homes, to places where the police are involved, scenes of overdoses, and people threatening suicide. EMS Division Chief Paul Miller of the Crawfordsville Fire Department says being invited into someone's home helps them get a fuller picture of someone's situation.
Provide more holistic services, make sure all the social determinants are taken care of, and really identify needs that would be hurdles to keeping somebody healthy.
The aim is to improve health outcomes, connect EMS, patients, and doctors, and lower costs by reducing hospital admissions and keeping people out of assisted care. And because it's such a new program, there's not much data on its efficacy in Crawfordsville. But research on similar mobile health programs supports this. In addition to Project Swaddle, the department assists people struggling with substance use disorder, fall prevention, people with chronic illnesses, and improving vaccination rates.
Typically, fire departments, 80% of their call volume is actually in the medical nature. We need to get upstream a lot of these healthcare issues preventatively, and we can do it through community paramedicine.
And now some are asking if Crawfordsville's program, where several factors successfully came together, can be repeated.
Our idea was to take the model that is in Crawfordsville and then replicate it in at least three different locations with different set of resources and different circumstances than Crawfordsville.
This is Amna Anwar, Senior Director at Indiana Rural Health Association. She's in charge of a grant to replicate the community paramedicine model. The grant assists hospitals in setting up community paramedicine programs for themselves and then showing them the financial payoff.
I think the biggest aims at collecting the data that we are trying to collect is to show that return on investment.
The investment, she says, is fewer hospital admissions and ER visits, which will lower hospital costs. But it remains to be seen if these outcomes will convince hospitals and communities to consider this type of novel healthcare. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett.
School nurses have taken on even more responsibility during the pandemic. Contact tracing, testing, calling parents of close contacts. But many school districts don't have enough school nurses. Peter Medlin spoke to one about the dire situation in her district.
Every school day during the pandemic is a challenge, but for school nurses, Monday mornings are uniquely difficult. That's when nurses like Corey Mauck of the Sycamore School District start following up with parents of students who call in sick and report COVID-related symptoms. Did they go somewhere over the weekend where they could have been exposed? Do they need a COVID test before they can come back? Do they need to talk to their pediatrician?
It's time-consuming, but very important. And then you have some of the kids that come to school, but then as that day goes on, they're not feeling well, and whatever they were exposed to over the weekend is starting to show itself, and then they come to the nurse office.
Malk says they've had around 10,000 health office visits from students this year. Not all those are because of COVID, but it's a heavy, sometimes overwhelming workload for a department, like many districts, that's understaffed. Sycamore has 7 schools and only 6 nurses. That includes Malk. As district nurse, she oversees all of their health operations, but because of these staff shortages, she's been thrust into covering individual buildings as well.
There just really isn't time to take a breath and even get caught up, so you kind of feel like you start every day behind.
They also don't have any substitute nurses, which means if a nurse is out for a day, Mauck and her colleagues step in and add schools and their hundreds, if not close to 1,000 students, to their duties.
We had nurses out on Thursday, Friday, and then again yesterday. So it looked like me covering one day a middle school building, which has about 900 students, and then the other 2 days was covering 2 buildings that had about 800 total students between the 2 buildings.
That's on top of her other responsibilities, which include providing COVID rapid tests, contact tracing, and notifying families when their child is a close contact or tested positive.
When they find out that they have to go home, it definitely pulls at your heartstrings, and we want the kids to be able to be in school.
The school nurse shortage in Sycamore is new this year. So without that safety net, Mauck says nurses often feel guilty when they miss a day because of their own health or to care for their kids. She says nurses' families have gone above and beyond.
We have mothers who have come from out of state to take care of sick children, even children who are positive with COVID, so that their nurse mom could continue to work because the need is so great.
So how many more nurses would they need to feel comfortable about staffing? Mauck says,
I mean, I would love to have a nurse in every building, or even, you know, just have some substitute nurses.
On top of the pressure to keep kids safe and healthy, she says they've also had to field calls from angry parents who disagree with the COVID-19 safety protocols. Mauck says that's new this year, too.
It has included raised voices, some accusations, even insults and profanity, and those can be really disheartening and difficult on top of all of the things, you know, that we've devoted ourselves to as nurses and health staff.
But there have been some silver linings as well. She says the health office can feel like an island sometimes, disconnected from the rest of the school. But the pandemic, as she says, has brought everyone to that island.
Administration and other staff across our district, as well as families, have really gotten a front row seat to how important it is to have a strong health department within your school district. We're more than just Band-Aids and ice packs.
Malk says they will continue to provide health services and emotional support to students facing a range of health needs in the district. The challenge right now is having enough time and staff to help them all. I'm Peter Medlin.
Still to come on Statewide, words targeted for banishment. A new list is out. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. 3D modeling plays an increasingly important role in performing complex surgeries. Tim Shelley took a look at how 3D modeling is already being put to use in Peoria and how it may be developing from an experimental technology to a standard of care.
Kevin Asbury went to see his doctor last September for some digestive issues. At first, it was chalked up to getting more fiber in his diet. But when the 40-year-old's blood work showed he was severely anemic, more testing was ordered. A November colonoscopy confirmed the worst.
They had found a mass. And so I was like, a tumor, like cancer? And he's like, yeah.
It was stage 4 colon cancer. And worse, the cancer had spread to Kevin's liver.
So I figured that was the end right there. I mean, you can't do surgery on a liver, I didn't think. So I know Melissa took it a little harder than I did.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of the cool, calm, and collected type. So I was just like, okay, we've got a problem. How are we going to fix it, you know?
Melissa, Kevin's wife, had reason to be worried. She's a certified surgical technologist.
You don't just go cut into the liver because it's so vascular and it bleeds like crazy.
Kevin's doctors ordered 6 rounds of chemotherapy followed by surgery to remove 4 tumors, one of which was situated near a major blood vessel. Surgeon Dr. Sonia Orcutt told him about 70% of his liver would be removed. That would lead to a 5-10% chance of liver failure. But a couple weeks before Kevin was scheduled to go to the OR, he got an interesting phone call asking for permission to share some of his medical info with Caterpillar. He agreed.
I guess Caterpillar took my CT and MRI images and they made a model, which I have here, kind of explain it a little better.
The blue and the pink things in this are the vessels coming in and out of the liver. You can also see them kind of spider webbing through the liver. And then there's purple spots in this translucent gel. And those purple spots are his tumors.
OSF Healthcare didn't possess the 3D printing technology needed for the intricate model, so they borrowed some of Caterpillar's industrial tech. Dr. Matthew Bramlett is a pediatric cardiologist at the University of Illinois College of Medicine Peoria and the Children's Hospital of Illinois. He's also the leader of the Advanced Imaging Modeling Lab, the Jump Training Simulation Education Center, which specializes in creating medical applications for 3D modeling tech.
You know, the printers that CAT has here in town afford us that unique opportunity where we can then not just hold it in our hand, but actually the surgeon can practice, can, you know, run a scalpel through the model.
The scale model of Kevin's liver, about the size of the average apple, costs $11,000 to manufacture. As an experimental treatment, insurance companies won't cover the cost. That means the organizational foundations eat those expenses, making its application limited to all but the most complex cases, like Kevin's. Bramlett says the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services just began conversations around approving 3D printing reimbursements last year. But he says his laboratory is already moving beyond 3D printing towards virtual reality modeling, a process he says is both cheaper and easier to use in most circumstances.
We're going to have to influence these regulators in D.C. to come and actually reimburse us for the technology we are using, because we've already bypassed the one that they're still experimenting with, really.
Bramlett says a 3D visualization helps surgeons put together a mental representation of the procedure they're going to perform.
Most people go through this process where, if you've got a 3D puzzle, right, you're kind of thinking through how to do it in your mind's eye. If you're going to be taking apart an engine and putting it back together, mechanics are going to be thinking about what they're going to be doing. That's what we're achieving.
Melissa Asbury says that having that mental representation helped her husband's surgeon achieve a better outcome. Kevin Asbury lost around 30% of his liver in the 6-hour tumor removal surgery, rather than the 70% initially expected.
Being able to print this image pretty much saved his life, because right now we can say that he is cancer-free. he went from having stage 4 colon cancer to, as far as his blood work and his scans, he has no cancer in his body at all right now. And 5-10 years ago, I don't think anybody could really say that if you had stage 4 any cancer, that you're going to be able to survive years down the road.
Dr. Matthew Bramlett says 3D virtual reality modeling is already a standard of care for complex surgeries at the Children's Hospital of Illinois. And they're sharing the technology and knowledge with other institutions around the country in hopes of generating the outcomes needed for wider scale adoption, which would be covered by insurance companies.
Anything that is a complex 3D problem with anatomy, this technology can have a dramatic impact.
Kevin Asbury encourages people to get a colonoscopy if they're suffering from digestive issues. And he wants people battling cancer to know there's always hope.
You just got to keep your faith, and every day is a blessing. That's how I feel. You know, every holiday is more special now. Everything happens for a reason, and, you know, cancer has kind of brought me closer to God. So, you know, you just draw close to Him, and everything's going to be fine.
I'm Tim Shelley.
You can learn more about how 3D modeling technology is being used in surgical preparation in Peoria. We have a link. It's at our website. Just go to nprillinois.org and look for Statewide. A new group led by formerly incarcerated people in Illinois has launched a campaign to end what it calls permanent punishments for people who have been convicted of felonies. Student journalist Vivian Law reported on Fully Free for Illinois Newsroom. Jim Meadows talked with her about what members of the Fully Free campaign told her about the problems they face after being released from prison.
So, for example, trying to find housing after you've gone out of prison without a support system can feel impossible. Marlon Chamberlain, who is the campaign manager for Fully Free, he says that even if someone isn't denied a housing application because of the felony conviction, due to the numerous laws that require background checks, they could be denied because of things like a low credit score, which is hard to maintain when you've been in prison. So there's restrictions that are written into laws like these kinds of housing laws and those that require background checks. There's also stigmas and stereotypes from the communities that they go back to that formerly incarcerated people face, and the fear that these people might have about going back to prison. So for example, this fear could prevent people from reporting like someone rear-ending them because they could risk having the accident blamed on them due to their past conviction. And another smaller example is Chamberlain was unable to chaperone his son's field trip because of his prison record that's over 25 years old. So it ranges from those that are written into law, but then there's also those that are more subtle but still have this impact on people.
Well, what does Fully Free want to change when it comes to these legal restrictions and the stigmas that you mentioned?
It's about dismantling these laws that restrict people, like these background checks, and that Fully Free wants to eliminate. But they're also trying to work with politicians to take away these restrictions and give support and resources to those that are formerly incarcerated. Illinois gives newly released prisoners $100 after release, which is not enough to restart a life, get everything back on track, as I've learned. And taking away some of these legal restrictions can help people find opportunities to get their life back together. Another component is education and informing the community about the different problems that these people face, which is what some of the local groups that are partnering with the campaign throughout the state are trying to do.
Now, for your reporting, you spoke with people from those local organizations who are working with the Fully Free campaign. I believe they included a TASC, a treatment alternative for local communities based in the Bloomington Normal area, and First Followers based in Champaign-Urbana. What did people from those groups have to say about why the current policies are unfair?
Yeah, so James Kilgore, who is co-director of First Followers, he says that after you serve your sentence, you should be done. You should be fully free. And Toy Beasley with TASC, he says people deserve the same rights as everyone else after serving a sentence. TASC and First Followers are both reentry programs that provide support systems for those after release. They help individuals with things like applying for a job or even math tutoring to earn a job certificate at Parkland College, which First Followers has done. Kilgore says that a lot of what they do to help people that are formerly incarcerated isn't profound in the sense that it's math tutoring, like these small things that a lot of people normally shouldn't have to get help with, but these programs exist because of the restrictive laws that prevent people from seeking opportunities on their own in the first place.
Well, what challenges do you see as the Fully Free campaign facing in terms of achieving their goals in changing these policies and laws?
Chamberlain, the campaign manager, talked a lot about the Black Lives Matter movement and these kinds of nationwide protests that have been happening in the past year and how Fully Free wouldn't be here today without them, because Black and Brown communities are also disproportionately impacted by mass incarceration. And as a result, they're also impacted more by these laws that restrict those released because of systemic racism. But he said it's really about trying to continue all that momentum from these protests and conversations. But there's also challenges with political polarization. And what they're trying to do to address that is frame this as less of a political issue and more of a human rights issue. They're trying to engage with people that normally aren't part of the conversation. It doesn't matter whether you're Democrat or Republican, as he said, because at the end of the day, it's a human rights issue that hurts communities on many different levels.
That's student journalist Vivian Law talking with Jim Meadows about Fully Free, a campaign to end penalties for people convicted of felonies in Illinois that extend beyond their prison sentences. Well, following their overuse, misuse, and general uselessness, 10 popular words and phrases from last year have been singled out. The English department at Lake Superior State University has announced its latest banishment list. Herb Trix tells us more.
The first banishment list was issued in 1976 as a tongue-in-cheek way to publicize a little-known state university in a far corner of northern Michigan. But it soon became a much-anticipated annual way to highlight the overuse and misuse of some words and phrases. The person in charge of the new list is Peter Zatmary, head of marketing for Lake Superior State. They received more than 1,200 nominations from around the world.
7 of our entries this year were everyday terms. That was one of our through lines, one of our themes, that common expressions seem to be on people's minds and tongues and fingers this particular year. And these common expressions were problematic in all sorts of ways, including our number one, wait, what? And when you think about it, the wait part, the person who's saying it and the recipient don't want to wait. And it's the what part. It's a false statement to express astonishment or misunderstanding or belief. And as one of our submitters says, well, I don't want to wait. The two should not go together in any circumstance.
Another from the everyday list is deep dive.
The deep dive, well, one issue is if you're diving, it's deep. So you don't need the deep. It's redundant. And the bigger issue is, when you dive, it's into water, not a subject.
And who else is more than tired of hearing this at the end of the day?
What's fascinating about that is, whatever the topic is, at the end of the day, the topic is usually still going on. The subject isn't over.
In past years, politics and elections have been a major source of entries for the banishment list. But he says COVID has sort of pushed them aside, starting with, you're on mute.
As numerous of our submitters said, hey, we're 2 years into this. People need to figure out where the mute button is. And the other entry is maybe a bit more poignant than the mock seriousness of our other entries, the new normal. We're 2 years into the pandemic. The new part of the normal, it's not new anymore. And several of our submitters and our judges hypothesize that maybe people are still not coming to terms with the pandemic because it's not new normal anymore. It's normal.
Also on the list is supply chain. It was nominated because, as one person said, it's become the scapegoat of everything that doesn't happen or arrive on time and of every shortage. Zatmary calls the early banishment list serious fun.
What we particularly enjoy is the ingeniousness and the passion of the reasons behind the nominations by people. They tend to put a great deal of thought, or even if it's a gut reaction, it's on point. And what we're very appreciative of our nominators across Michigan, the U.S., and around the world is they have as much mock serious fun with this as we do.
Lake Superior State is already accepting nominations for the next list of banished words and phrases, and you can see the more than 1,000 from past years' lists at lssu.edu/banished words. I'm Herb Trix.
Well, that's all the time we have for Statewide. Join us next week. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. All of our episodes are available at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.